to figure out which one it is, positive or negative, you have to look at the context. And that'll tell you something about whether or not it was likely to be alcoholic, likely to be non-alcoholic, and what's being taught. Three other words that you'll find in the New Testament that I found in the New Testament, each one only appears once. But I want to give them to you just in fairness to the treatment. Glucose. Sound familiar? Glucose. Sugar. I think we get glucose from glucose, the Greek word that's used here. And it's sweet, fresh grape juice that's turned into fermented wine. You'll only find it referenced in Acts 2:13. Then there's sakira. Remember we looked at shikar, the Hebrew word, last time for heavily fermented drink? Well, sakira is a Greek word that they borrowed the Hebrew. It's heavily alcoholic, and you only find it in Luke 1:15. And if you're not familiar with what's going on in Luke 1:15, it's talking about John the Baptist and the fact that he will have no strong drink or wine. The other one is oxos. O-X-O-S. And this is a vinegar or sour wine that was cheap. This was the ripple of the day. This was, you know, the dirt cheap kind of beer. Actually, alcohol. Anyhow, this was common amongst Roman soldiers, principally because it was alcoholic and you could get it cheap. It happens to also be what they offered Jesus on the cross. And it's only referenced in Mark 15:36. By the way, I don't know Greek. I couldn't sit down and make one sentence in Greek unless I was and memorized something from the Bible. How do I know all this Greek? Why can I tell you that? Because I have a computer program that helps me do it. I would encourage you. How many of you have invested in computer games? How many of you guys have invested in computers? Almost everybody has computers these days, right? That next step for you to figure out for yourself what the word is saying is to look at some of these words. I mentioned earlier that I've become kind of a fan of the New American Standard Bible, the 1995 edition. The reason being is it's the most literal English translation that's out there, other than an interlinear, at least according to the reviews and the different things I've seen, which means that it's going to tell me what the authors said as accurately as you can transfer it from the original language into English. Other translations, like the NIV, try to tell you what the authors meant. You catch the difference? They're much easier to read, easier to understand, whenever they tell you, well, this is what they meant to say. But then you're also depending on the translator's ability to know what they meant. This is a New American Standard that I'm using with all these lectures today. And in fact, if you're looking at my notes from Luke, I'm using New American Standard. I would much prefer to know what they said and figure out what they meant. Because I think we have the ability to do that in a way that we have never had before. I grew up in a day, Bob grew up in a day. Bob, you definitely remember the days when to figure out what any word meant or to check out your translator's job in their translation, you had to have a library table and you had to have several hundred dollars, if not thousands of dollars, invested into all the different books. And I remember the days trying to figure out something like this was just to look up one word. Holy cow. You needed a Strong's Concordance. You probably would want a Thompson Chain reference. You'd need Nelson's. You'd need all these different things. And then whenever you found a verse, you'd have to come over here. You had to physically get up and flip pages and then go around the table and flip all the pages and turn them all to the same thing. And because that was a lot of work and a lot of expense, not a lot of people actually did that. Some people did. It's why a lot of people learned the original languages so that they didn't have to get up. Right? I'd rather spend 4 years in college and learn this than to have to pay for all those books and keep looking it up every time. But now we live in a day whenever it is so easy to get information that there's really almost no excuse not to. To him who's been given much, much is required. I hope to challenge you not just to take my word for it. On any of the things that I try to be a Bible teacher. I try to be a good Bible teacher. And at my best, I will be wrong and not know it at times. Because I've been teaching long enough that I'm now going back and saying, I taught it this way before and I'm wrong. I was wrong. I understand that differently now. And here's the thing I didn't understand back then. I've done that enough times now to know that as I stand before you today, there are things that I still probably do not, I don't know. You're always kind of handicapped by what you don't know, right? That's the best you can do. Do you really just want to take my word for it? Or do you, and I hope you would consider taking my word for it, but I hope you don't. I hope to be credible enough that you would consider what I say. But man, buy a computer program. If you're a Macintosh fan like me, I like Accordance. It's a little pricey. It'll run you about $150 to get started. But then you can add on little things that you need. And it's so cool. I wish I could show you a screenshot of what I can do with this. But I pull up three different versions, three different translations of the Bible at a time, and they're all synced together. And as I roll my cursor over any word, it'll highlight in the other panes how that word was translated. And sometimes they're very different. And with just a click of a mouse, I can look at all the Greek or Hebrew words and all the different ways those words were mean, all the possible different meanings. I also have panes underneath that with the United Bible Society's translator's notes. In other words, this is what they give to the translators to help them figure out how to translate into whatever language they're translating it into, the original stuff. And then I have Tyndale commentaries, because they're some of the better ones. That's a little public service announcement. Sorry, got off track there just a little bit. But that's how I know about these Greek words. And you can do it. You can take as much time as I've taken. You can probably do it even with less time than I've done. This ability to figure out what the Word of God says is not beyond your reach. You don't have to rely on professionals to figure out what God wants. I really want to impress that upon you, because we're at this point where as a church we're either going to become dependent on our leaders, or we're going to have our own faith, and our leaders are just going to help us develop that faith. And I know our leaders here just want to help you develop your faith. So I want you to be able to know how to get the tools into your hands so that you can go and dig this stuff up for yourself and make up your own mind. I mean, that's what we're doing. Like for you to do it too. Okay, so those are the four words that I found that are most commonly used in the Bible in the New Testament in Greek. So here are some positive references. I mentioned three. Here they are. The first one is found in Luke 10, verse 34. And this is about the Good Samaritan. It says, "And came to him and bandaged up his wounds, pouring oil and wine on them. And he put him on his own beast and brought him into an inn and took care of him." See, now the word wine here is oinos. Now it could be non-alcoholic or alcoholic. Remember, that word is used generically of anything that came from a grape. But there's a strong implication that it's probably alcoholic because it's used for a medicinal purpose. You know, you can pour alcohol in a wound and it will serve as an antibacterial agent to help clean out a wound. And that's what I think we're reading about here with the Good Samaritan. And because of that, it's a positive reference. Now, this one I want to take just a little bit of time with this next verse. This one comes out of John 2, verses 3 through 11. In my experience, most of the time whenever people have argued that it's okay to socially drink and be a Christian, that God has no problem with it, they usually go to the Canaanite wedding. And Jesus turned water into wine. His first miracle was just something to keep the party going. So, obviously, God doesn't have a problem with us drinking socially. He just doesn't want us to get drunk, right? Well, is that really what we're told this about? I mean, is that really what John 2 and the Canaanite wedding is really telling us? So I want to take just a couple of seconds, maybe a little bit more on this one than I would with other passages. Let's just pull it apart for a second. Starting with verse 3, it says, "When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said," and by the way, this is oinos that it's always using, so it could be alcoholic or non-alcoholic. I have reason to believe, and I'll show you later why I think it was alcoholic. This is, "When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, 'They have no wine.'" His mom walks up to him and says, "They're out of wine." And Jesus says this very peculiar thing to her. He says, "Woman." He addresses his mom as woman. What does that have to do with us? "My hour has not yet come." Okay, so I had to dig into this and then try to figure this out a little bit, because not all of the translations even read this kind. Some of them sound even more brutal, like Jesus is chastising Mary or something. So let's look at this. First of all, him calling his mother woman is not a sign of disrespect. but it is a sign of distancing his relationship with her. Later, Jesus would call Mary woman again at the cross. You remember that? That's whenever he entrusts John to her care. So Jesus, remember, he addresses her as a woman. I think that's a key to understanding this whole thing about what has this got to do with me? Statement that he makes. What does it have to do with us? Because he's distancing himself from her. Now remember, he has spent his whole life as her son, under her care until such time as he became the one to provide for her and to take care of her. I guess he would have called her mom or some equivalent up to then. But now he calls her woman. I think it's because Mary needed to recognize that Jesus is not just her son, but he's the promised Messiah. And that Jesus is telling her, look, we talked about this. I got to be about my Father's business now. Not just about your business. Now this phrase, what does this have to do with us, is a Hebrew idiom. In other words, it's a common phrase that had a meaning that everybody sort of understood. Like it's raining cats and dogs. Nobody thinks that there's actually poodles and kitties falling from the sky when we say that. We think, oh, well, yeah, that's what we call an idiom. We throw that out there, oh, it must be raining hard. Just stepped in a poodle. Anyway, so this is, I would have thought everybody by this time would have heard that one, but anyway. Literally, what that's saying, the words are, what to me and you? That's what Jesus was saying. That was the idiom. What to me and you? You'll find this phrase in several different passages. It's hard to make sense of because it doesn't come over into English very well. But what Jesus is saying, I mean, what it means is, he's asking, what is there in common between us? What do we have in common? It distances the relationship of the two parties by saying, what do we have in common here? You know, I know you're concerned about this, but why should I be concerned about this? Jesus is saying that he's entered into the purpose of his mission on earth, his Father's business. And all his activities would now be subject to the fulfillment of that mission. That's what he's communicating to Mary. And at the same time, Jesus' reply must have indicated to Mary that he would take care of the problem. Because her very next thing that she does is to tell the servants what he said. Do whatever he says. So she's not offended. She's not put off. But Jesus is saying, listen, this is my purpose. Right from the get-go, when you really slow this down and try to figure out and see this not with Western eyes, not with prejudiced eyes or biased eyes that want to prove your point, there's a slightly different meaning that starts to emerge in the very first part of this story. Jesus is here on behalf of the Father to do what the Father wants him to do. He's not there to ensure that there's a good party. And I don't think that alcohol was the point of this passage. Let's keep reading, see if you agree. Verse 5. His mother said to the servants, whatever he says to you, do it. Now there were 6 stone water pots set there for the Jewish custom of purification. These guys, they were always into the water, man. They had more ritual bathings and washings. It was crazy. How do you know? Well, look how big the water jars were. There were 6 of them, and they each held somewhere between 20 and 30 gallons each. That's a lot of water. Verse 7, Jesus said to them, fill the water pots with water. So they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, draw some out now and take it to the head waiter. So they took it to him. When the head waiter tasted the water, which had become wine, and did not know where it had come from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the head waiter called the bridegroom. And he said to him, every man serves the good wine first, and when the people have drunk freely, then he serves the poorer wine. But you've kept the good wine until now. Which means Jesus made some really good wine. He didn't do anything cheaply. What constitutes good? Was it good because it was extra heavily alcoholic? Was it good because it was extra sweet? We don't know. Was it good because it was fresh? The word oinos could be an alcoholic. So there's a debate there, and there's no satisfactory way to settle that debate, as far as I'm concerned. Although, again, I think the implication is that it probably was alcoholic. Why do I think that it was alcoholic? Because that word, the word's drunk freely. Remember, after he tastes it, he comes over and he says to the bridegroom, wow, usually everybody, after they've drunk freely, that's whenever you bring out the cheaper hooch. Because they can't tell the difference. Those words, drunk freely, is the Greek word methysiko. Methysko, that's it. M-E-T-H-Y-S-K-O. Methysko. Which means to intoxicate or to be drunk. So if it was alcoholic, I don't know if this would be the statement that he would make. Maybe he's saying, look, yeah, people get in, you know, they get drunk and you start off with the sweet fresh wine that isn't fermented normally, and then you go to the stuff that's alcoholic. Which would have meant, if that's true, that means that their preference in society was for sweet, fresh stuff, or lightly alcoholic, and then progress into the worst stuff. But anyhow, this guy is amazed at the quality of wine that's being given. He didn't know that Jesus had turned water into wine just by saying so. Now, this verse ends up with, in verse 11, it says, this beginning of his signs, this was his first miracle. I don't think Jesus, you'll watch the History Channel, that'll mess you up. They have some of the, I always get intrigued whenever they have something on about the Bible or about Jesus, and I've just learned not to even watch. Because one in 20 of them will have 50% good stuff, and the rest are 100% nonsense. And have you seen the ones about, well, you know, when Jesus was 12, right after he got back from the temple, he kind of figured out that he was God. And you know what he did? Like any 12-year-old boy, he went down to the creek, and he got some mud, and he made little clay pigeons, and then he spoke them into life, and they flew off. And where they get this nonsense and dribble, I don't know. But according to John, who was like an eyewitness and hung out with him, this was his first miracle. And he was 30 years old. I don't think the clay pigeon thing has got any accuracy. So if you're wondering what happened between 12 and 30, relax. Jesus didn't do his first miracle until Cana, according to Scripture. And it says, this is the beginning of his signs, and he manifested his glory. Manifested means made known. He manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. You want to look for the purpose of why Jesus turned water into wine. There it is. Which, if you're going to take this passage and say, see, this means it's okay for me to drink publicly, I would ask you to ask a couple questions. You may be right, but you could be wrong. And some questions that might help you is, why am I drinking? Do you have the same reason for drinking that Jesus had, for making the wine? Am I revealing God's glory by my drinking? That's what Jesus was making wine for. Do you really have the purposes of Jesus in mind? Last one, is this helping people put their faith in Jesus? Because that's what Jesus was doing. Now, as much as I've studied the Bible, and I haven't studied as much as some, and I'm not trying to say I've studied a whole lot, but I have noticed in my studies that Jesus seldom, if ever, did something without it having a real rich symbolic value. It seems like he did things for a reason. It doesn't always explain to us what that reason was. Sometimes it does. I think that there might be a reason why Jesus turned water into wine. John records this. It's also in John that John tells us that Jesus said, I am the vine. I am the true vine. Well, what do vines do? They turn water into wine. I think that may be at the core of what Jesus was doing by turning water into wine. I don't think it was about alcohol. I think Jesus was revealing who he is. And there was some symbolism here. He's the true vine. And to take this passage and try to turn it into an argument about I can drink alcohol seems to really do it a lot of injustice, since the big aha is, no, this is probably about Jesus being the vine. Okay, so I took a little time with that. Thanks for indulging me. The next question that this passage brings out is, did Jesus drink wine? In my earlier days, I would have answered no. He didn't drink wine, but that reflected my bias towards the evils of alcohol. I now believe that it's probably likely that he did drink wine. I do not believe he ever drank too much. I don't believe that he was ever drunk, because drunkenness is clearly a sin, and Jesus did not sin. But in a society where it was common to drink wine. I think he probably did drink wine. If you want Bible for it, this is the closest thing that I've got. We're not told specifically that he did or didn't, but you can look to consider Luke chapter 7, verses 33 through 34. Now, he's dealing with his critics in this passage, and he makes this statement. He says, "For John the Baptist has come eating no bread and drinking no wine, and you say he has a demon." So here's a teetotaler, a guy who's abstaining, and all the critics are saying, "You don't do what all of us do. You won't drink wine." He's got a demon. That's why he's out there not drinking. That's why he's doing this weird stuff. That's why he's so strict. Verse 34, he says, "The Son of Man has come eating and drinking. And you say, behold, a gluttonous man and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners." It sounds to me like Jesus is saying, yeah, I eat and I drink. And you guys are accusing me of being a drunkard and a person of low character, that I hang out with the worst. Well, we know that Jesus hung out with tax collectors and sinners. He wasn't one of them. He was in their company, but it was there to help them because they were sick, he said, and they needed a doctor. So did Jesus drink? This verse does not, some people might say that this is not a confession. This is not a statement of what he did. He's just saying, look at my critics. You guys can't be happy no matter what I do or what anybody does. You're going to pick apart anybody you want to pick apart. Others might look at it and say, well, that kind of looks like he might have drank wine. And I don't think that there's any reason here to believe that he didn't drink. I don't believe there's any reason to believe that he drank to get drunk. The word wine there is, again, well, actually, he didn't use, yeah, he does. The word wine is oinos. It could be either fermented or unfermented. But the accusation that he's a drunkard probably doesn't apply to grape juice. I don't know how much grape juice would you have to drink to get drunk. Anyway, so let's move on a little bit here. This is the third positive reference. Now, I think that the Canaanite wedding and turning water into wine is a positive reference because I think Jesus revealed who he was. So here's the third one that I think is positive. And it's in 1 Timothy 5:23. I mentioned this a little bit last night. Paul tells Timothy, says, "No longer drink water exclusively, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments." The word wine is oinos again, which means it could be alcoholic, it could not be alcoholic. Most people shied away from thinking that this was a non-alcoholic reference because they said, well, what benefits does just grape juice have for your stomach? It's the fermented stuff. I remember when I was a kid, the doctor prescribed my dad to drink a beer a day for an intestinal thing that he had going on. Dad didn't like beer, he didn't drink it. But that it was not that uncommon to hear of doctors prescribing an alcoholic mixture. So for that reason, most people think that Paul is talking about an alcoholic kind of wine here. And I would have, until recently, said, yeah, of course, that makes really good sense. However, later studies, more recent studies, medical studies, have started to say, you know, grape juice has some of the same benefits that wine does, minus the alcohol. How many times have you read about wine is good for your heart? It's good for your digestion. It's good for some different things. I'm not an expert. I've said it before. I'm going to say it again. I'm not a doctor, and I'm not an expert on alcohol, so I can't verify any of these things. My suspicion is that this is talking about alcoholic wine. And again, for the reasons that we stated before, potable water, water was made potable through the application of wine. But some things to note about this verse is this is not recreational or social advice. Paul isn't saying, Timothy, why don't you loosen up and have a drink? You know, you're in a tough spot. You're a young guy. The church can be cruel. You're in hostile territory. Man, you need to lighten up and relax a little bit. You know, it's millet time. That's not what he's saying. This is medical advice. And apparently, Paul's concerned about his stomach and some other frequent ailments. And apparently, Timothy is avoiding wine where other people take it for granted. So I have to ask the question, why is Timothy avoiding this? Why is he avoiding what is common, what is across the board a socially acceptable, even a taken for granted that, yeah, you're going to drink it kind of thing? Why is Timothy abstaining? Why does Paul have to tell him, go ahead and let some of this in? And again, we don't know. We're not told why Paul gives him this advice, other than the treatment of certain physical conditions. We're not told why Timothy is abstaining from wine. So we're left to speculate. My speculation is the next verses we're going to look at will tell us something about the reason why Timothy might have been avoiding wine. So we're going to look at some of the negative references in the New Testament. Let's start off with Romans 14:21. It says there, it is good. Now this is Paul again, and remember, this Roman crowd, they're fighting like dogs, right along racial lines, Jews and Gentiles. And this is chapter 14, and he's dealing with meat sacrificed to idols, special days, and the things that some people think you've got the liberty in Christ to do, and others think, no, this would not please God, and they're fighting about it. And he makes this statement. He says, it's good not to eat meat or to drink wine or to do anything by which your brother stumbles. The word wine is oinos. From the context, it really looks likely that he's talking about alcoholic. Paul is arguing that we should not do anything that might hinder another believer, including drinking wine. I don't know about you, but apparently it seems to me that drinking alcohol can hinder some of believers. Do you think that's true today? You know, I know that there are people in our congregation who come here every Sunday who've had a past with alcohol and face the temptation. There are some of them that are still alcoholics and still struggling for their sobriety. And they wonder if they're going to go to heaven because they haven't been able to beat this back yet. They're caught in something. And so they count the days that they've been sober. They count the hours that they've been sober. And they want holiness. They want righteousness. They want desperately for God to be able to use them to bring heaven to earth. But yet it's right there, snarling, saying, come on, I can make it better. I can make you feel better. You've done it before, it doesn't matter. No one will know. What does it do to that brother or sister if he or she walks into a restaurant and I'm sitting there, big old can of beer or a mixed drink, some form of alcohol? Could that hurt that brother or sister and help them to relax just a little bit and say, well, maybe one drink wouldn't hurt? People that I respect that I know are serious about God, they drink. Maybe it would be okay for me. Maybe I could handle just one. Well, what happens if they can't handle just one? Have I contributed to that brother or sister stumbling? Could be. I'll take it another direction. What if you are absolutely convinced that it's a sin for a Christian to ever take a drink of wine? What if you believe that it is sinful, it is dishonoring to God, it is absolutely rejecting His purposes of bringing heaven to earth, and you see me drinking? What would that do to you? Could that stumble you? That is more the context of this statement. And Paul said, it's not good to eat or drink or to do anything that stumbles your brother. I take that to mean that even though I may have the freedom to drink alcohol, I do not have the freedom to ignore how that affects you. And it's better for me to say no to something that really wouldn't matter to God, that I might like, and to place you at a higher value than myself. As I understand it, to be a Christian, we have to have a total self-sacrifice. And according to Philippians 2, I'm supposed to have the mind of Christ, and I'm supposed to consider others as better than myself. So I'm supposed to first consider Jesus, then I'm supposed to consider you. Because Jesus is who He is, and because He's that kind of a master, I don't have to look out for me. I don't have to look out for me because He's looking out for me. But He's looking out for me in order for me to look out for you. And that isn't just for me. That's for all Christians. Romans 14:21, I think, brings into view that maybe this is what Timothy was worried about. Maybe Timothy was worried about how his example might affect somebody. Whether it was his issue or not, I think it ought to be ours. That's my thought. 1 Corinthians 5:11. Paul's talking again. And he's talking to the Corinthians, who seem to get everything wrong. And he says, but actually, I wrote to you not to associate with any so-called brother if he is an immoral person, or a covetous person, or an idolater, or a reveler, or a drunkard, or a swindler. Not even to eat with such a person. Why is Paul this stark? I think the difference is someone who calls themselves a brother and acts like that. We're not to associate with anyone who calls himself a Christian and yet participates in certain things. People who have a habit of getting drunk are specifically mentioned. So you call yourself a Christian and you have a habit of getting drunk. You can, if I'm going to obey what the apostle of Jesus said to do, is I'm not going to have meals with you, and I'm not going to be associated with you. Again, what was the whole thing about the priests in the Old Testament? They were supposed to draw a difference between what's common and what's holy. What everybody does and what God has called a certain people to do. Everybody else is out there depending on wine and alcohol for something. And being a drunkard, you're depending on it for a lot. And it's really destroying your life. And that's pretty common. We're called to live differently and to distinguish between the two camps. And when you got someone who says, no, I'm in this camp, but I act like that camp, do you think they're bringing heaven to earth? Now, you check my math. This is my opinion again. But whenever Jesus says, teach us to pray, they said to Jesus, okay, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Your kingdom come, your will be done. Here on earth, just like it is in heaven. I take that to mean that whenever we do God's will, living here and now by the rules that they live by in heaven, that we're bringing a little bit of heaven to earth. I think the opposite has to, here's where the math comes in. That wasn't math. That's just what it says. But if I obey Jesus and I bring heaven to earth, what do I bring to earth whenever I don't obey Jesus? Hell? Hell would be the opposite of heaven, wouldn't it? Let's do a little math again. What's in heaven? Well, there's God. There's purpose. There's promise. There's order. Things have a reason. What would be in hell? Well, an absence of God, an absence of order, chaos, an absence of purpose. There's no profit from my pain. There's an absence of promise. This may not promise me anything good. And when we disobey Jesus, I think we bring those values, those commodities, into the world around us. You bring it into your family. You bring it into your parenting. You bring it into the workplace. You bring it into the school. You bring it into your neighborhood. You bring it into your house. We have been commissioned, and I cannot lean on this seriously enough, guys. This is not about alcohol. This is about who we are in Christ. We have been commissioned to bring heaven here. Where's here? Anywhere you are. If you're in the checkout line at the grocery store, just notice the way people act. You know, I buy groceries. You buy groceries. Do you notice people who feel like they're the most important people in the world standing in line and upset with anything and everything, complaining about everything, treating people rudely and feeling like, well, who cares? I'm me, that's them. I don't think Christians are supposed to be that way. I think we're supposed to communicate other things, good things. We can bring heaven right there into the checkout aisle at Walmart. We're supposed to notice people. We're supposed to be noticeable for the differences in our life. We're supposed to distinguish the difference between the holy, which is what you are. I'm not saying that you're holy because you're so good. That's where that whole imagery of holier than thou comes from. You've heard that idiom. That's the people who think, well, I'm better than the person who doesn't go to church. That is terrible and displeasing to the Lord. But understanding that I have been set aside for a purpose and not losing focus of your purpose is exactly what being holy is about. And you, everyone in this room, has a purpose in God's kingdom. And you have a purpose here on this earth to bring heaven right where you are. And you do it by staying in step with the Spirit. And to claim that you're doing that and you're acting like those who don't give a rip about God and His kingdom and don't care to draw a difference between the two camps is to totally reject the purpose. And we're commissioned in this verse to ignore and to draw a difference between us so that the world gets the idea that that one is not telling the truth. They say they're on this team, but we're not having anything to do with them. We're not playing with them. And there's more than just alcohol in here. Immorality. We do real good, I think, around here with standing apart from people who want to sleep around with someone they're not married to. Covetousness. Covetous. People who want things maybe that they can't afford. I think that we have a tendency to turn a blind eye to that one. Ooh, why? An idolater. Someone who puts other things besides God at a higher level. See, an idolater, the way we tend to think about that, is someone who bows down to Artemis or Zeus or Thor or whoever, and they're hoping that if I please that God will do something good for me. Well, we don't have Zeus and Artemis and Thor in our society, but we have paycheck, we have position, we have all sorts of pleasures. We use money not as a tool, but as a scorecard to judge ourselves and to judge other people. And it is just as offensive to our mission to bring heaven to earth as being a drunkard. So I hope that this whole alcohol weekend to you is about more than alcohol. Because you'd be missing the forest for the trees to make this all about alcohol. So let's keep moving. I'm off my soapbox, sorry. Let's look at Galatians 5, 19 through 21. He says there, "Now the sins of the flesh are evident." In other words, you can see it when someone isn't listening to God. You don't have to speculate. It's obvious. And here they are. Immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmities, strife, jealousy, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envying, drunkenness, carousing, and things like these, of which I forewarn you, just as I have forewarned you, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. There are a lot of things in this list. I could take a lot of time going through all of them. I do not want to separate alcohol and drunkenness out to make this verse about that. But for the sake of this seminar, I'm only going to focus on that one. It is in the list with a whole lot of other things. And people who practice. Now, there's a difference between having a drink and practicing. And for those of you who may be alcoholics, who are fighting for your sobriety, there is a difference between falling off the wagon and rejecting your Savior or losing your salvation. We'll talk more about that privately if you want to talk more about it. Such verses as this can make people very insecure, and that's not what the intention is about. Drunkenness is an act of the sinful nature. And by the way, the very same thing is said over in 1 Corinthians 6:10. Let's look at Ephesians 5, 15 through 18. And I'm about out of time, so I got to move. He says, "Therefore, be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of your time because the days are evil." Do you think maybe this was on Timothy's mind? Those of us who are older, 50 and above, do you live with the idea that, you know, I only have so much time left? That's on my mind a lot. I feel like time is short. I've only got just a little bit less. There's more miles behind me than lay ahead of me. I've only got, you know, we're late in the day. The sun's going down for my service to the Master. It's time to make hay. I need to be doing what I was paid to do. I need to be busy about the Master's work. I need to be bringing heaven to wherever I am. And I don't need to be wasting my opportunities. That's how Paul starts this off. We need to live as wise, not as unwise, and we need to make the most of our time. It says, so then do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. See, this is why I'm trying really hard to impress upon you the need for you to read the Bible for yourself, for all that it's worth. For you not to just rely on the opinions of people that you trust. It's okay to hear those opinions. It's okay to take advice. It's okay to lean on other people's understandings to a certain degree. But to depend on them is a different thing. To use someone else's opinion to help you come to your own is a good thing. But to depend on someone's opinion is like, well, I've done looking at it because Tom looked at it. Come on, man. It's time to do more than that. He says, understand what the will of the Lord is. That's what we should be after. And again, arguments about gray issues usually come up whenever we're not really looking so much to figure out what the will of the Lord is, but we're really trying to figure out how we can get as much of our will into an acceptable column underneath the Lord's will. So I think that we really ought to move the question about alcohol from can a Christian drink to should a Christian drink? Can a Christian smoke marijuana? Should a Christian smoke marijuana? Take any of those gray issues and change it from can to should. And I think that it will put you a little bit closer to finding the path. Okay, he says, so then understand what the will of the Lord is and do not get drunk with wine. Apparently, I don't know about you, but whenever I see a statement like, don't be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is and don't get drunk with wine, I think there's a thought that connects those two. He says, for that is dissipation. But instead, be filled with the Spirit. What's dissipation? You know what it means to dissipate something, right? It breaks it apart. Squandering of energy. Whenever we drink and we rely on alcohol, getting drunk, some things are breaking apart and falling apart. But instead, the contrast for us who are holy, set apart for God, is to not be filled up with wine, but to be filled with the Spirit. There's a whole lot more I could say about being filled with the Spirit, but I don't have enough time. How wise is it to drink something that leads us away from where the Spirit of God leads? Your mind will see perverse things, will think perverse thoughts. Your eyes will see strange thoughts. Remember what the Old Testament said? Is that really something that you want to add into your life? If you really want to be led by the Spirit. 1 Thessalonians 5, 4 through 8 says, but you, brethren, are not in darkness. Again, the big picture is about two kingdoms. A kingdom of darkness, a dominion of darkness, which took over the world when sin entered the world and took heaven away from the overlap with the earth that was there in the beginning. And they call that the dominion of darkness. And now the kingdom of light, where heaven is beginning to overlap with earth again. That's the contrast, and that's what's in view in this verse in 1 Thessalonians. You, brethren, are not in darkness. You're not a part of the kingdom of darkness, the dominion of darkness, that the day would overtake you like a thief, for you all are all sons of light and sons of day. We are not of night nor of darkness. So then let us not sleep as others do, but let us be alert and sober. For those who sleep do their sleeping at night, and those who get drunk at night. I think he's talking about more than the time of the clock or the phase of the sun, the rotation in the earth. But you know what? Again, as a cop, I dealt with most of my drunks at night. So there is some similarity there. He says, but since we are of the day, let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and love as a helmet, the hope of salvation. The Greek word translated as sober is a tough one to pronounce. It's neophioi. I don't know. Neophioi. Anyway, it means to abstain from wine. The root word, the meaning of the word that's used here about staying sober is to abstain from wine. Some translations will call it being watchful. You'll see it there, the same word translated as watchful in 2 Timothy 4:5 and 1 Peter 4:7. Let's look at 2 Timothy 3:2 through 3. And I have just got three more verses here to cover, and then I will cut us loose. Three more verses in 3 minutes. Do you think I can do it? 1 Timothy 3:2 through 3. An overseer then must be above reproach. An overseer, that's episkopos. the Greek word. That gets translated overseer, shepherd, or elder. Episcopos. Sound like Episcopalian? That's because their form of government in their church has to do with elders. It's another story. Overseers. You have some overseers here. Me and Tim and Gary have been recognized as overseers. So this is specifically to me. An overseer, then, must be above reproach. The husband of one wife, as if I would want one or more than one, because, baby, you're all I need. Anyway. That is true. Temperate. I'm supposed to be temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine, or pugnacious, but gentle. This is what I am supposed to be. Gentle, peaceable, and free from the love of money. This is not a single verse about... I mean, there's not a single issue in this verse. Not addicted to wine is in there, but there are other things that I'm not to be. Overseers are to be above reproach. The qualities that follow the command are given to establish what being above reproach looks like. Do you understand that? If you are to lead a life that is above reproach, don't do these things, but do those things. It's right there. It's not controversial. I don't have to quibble about this. I don't have to say it's my opinion. I can say, read it. It's that. Elders are not ordered to abstain completely from alcohol, but they are not to be drunk or even to have alcohol as a prominent, predominant influence in their lives. It's very similar to what you'll find written in Titus 1:7. Titus 1:7. Let's look at 1 Timothy 3:8. Says their deacons likewise must be men of dignity, not double-tongued or addicted to much wine or fond of sordid gain. Again, the word wine is oinos. I don't think they're talking about grape juice. I think they're probably talking about alcoholic wine. And deacons are not required to abstain completely, but they are not to be drunk or even have alcohol as a predominant influence in their lives. Look at Titus 2:3. Older women. Now we talked about elders and deacons. That sounds like a different class of Christian, right? It's not. There are not two classes of Christian. We all do different things because we're like a body. And there are different maturity levels. And elder means we're older. We've been worked on a little longer. You know, we're showing a little bit more signs of being completed than, you know, because maturity has to do with being complete than some others. But now look, in case you're tempted to say, okay, well, there's a stricter line for elders and deacons. I get that. That makes sense. Check this one out. Titus 2:3. Older women, likewise, are to be reverent in their behavior, not malicious gossips. Boy, how I wish we would take the commands about how we talk as seriously as the commands about how we have sex or don't. Because we will run you out of this church on a rail if you want to sleep around and won't repent. But we don't hardly say anything about when you're talking like an idiot. And I don't know, man, that really gets on my nerves. Because I've been one of them that's talked the worst at times. And I've been allowed to at times. I've been allowed to be ungracious. I've been allowed to be mean. I've been allowed to be slanderous. I've been allowed to, and nobody ever batted an eye. Because leaders considered above me did it all the time. And how dare we put an emphasis on sexual morality and not verbal morality? I don't see anybody in the scriptures drawing that kind of a difference. Apparently, they're both very important. It says they're not to be irreverent in their behavior, not malicious gossips, nor enslaved to much wine. Sounds like the same command to older women. They're supposed to be teaching what is good. Apparently, drinking much wine is incompatible with leadership at any level. At least being enslaved to it. Again, I don't think this is a prohibition of any kind of use of alcohol under any circumstances. You can read for yourself, but it's not to be a prominent feature in the lives of older women, of elders, or of deacons. Do you really think that those three classes are different than other Christians? Or do you think this maybe tells us something about the lifestyle of all Christians? Okay, so what is the New Testament picture? The New Testament picture presents an overall message about alcohol that is not wise. It's not beneficial except for some medical purposes. And it's not complementary to a godly life. And again, this is presented, these statements are presented in a context in which alcohol is as normal as drinking water. Leaders in the church are specifically warned not to have a close connection with alcohol.